will be talking a lot about jobs this hour. President Obama's jobs plan unveiled last night. The job organized labor is taking on for the 2012 elections. The plans of the GOP candidates who want the job of president. And a state worker loses his job in a controversy involving the photo ID law. Plus, it's your job to add to the list at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, or you can tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, September the 9th. We have two guests with us from different political perspectives to talk with you about these issues and more. And they are Owen Robinson, columnist at the West Bend Daily News, blogger at bootsandsabers.com. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Joy.
And also with us is Ruth Conniff, political editor at The Progressive. And she joins us by phone as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to talk a lot about jobs, and we will talk jobs in just a moment. But the lead story in NPR should not be ignored. The 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks is coming up, obviously, on Sunday. And it was just revealed yesterday that there is a credible but still unconfirmed terrorism threat tied to the anniversary of September 11th, Al-Qaeda presumably wanting to make a show on Sunday, somewhere maybe in New York or Washington, D.C. What do you think about that, Owen?
Well, I
think we lost Owen. We will try to get Owen back, and I will ask you, Ruth Conniff, your thoughts on the anniversary of September 11th and this terror threat.
Well, I think we have been living with this new reality since September 11th, 10 years ago. Even seeing the news last night about the terror threat didn't cause the kind of panic that it would have before that time, and it's kind of amazing to remember how different a world it was before we, as Americans, felt threatened by terrorism. But the other thing that it reminded me of was that, it is President Obama who found and assassinated Osama bin Laden. So that is one of the reasons that we are on high alert now. It's the prospect of revenge for the killing of Osama bin Laden. And so in that sense, that is the closing of that chapter. We are no longer in this endless hunt for Osama bin Laden. And I think that, this is something that we've grown somewhat accustomed to, that we deal with these high alerts from time to time. And so far, we have been safe, and we haven't had another attack like September 11th.
And we have Owen Robinson back. Your thoughts, Owen, on the terror threat?
Well, I think it's, first off, it's remarkable that we've gone 10 years now, almost 2 days left, without a major terrorist attack. We of course, had the tragedy in Fort Hood and the shoe bomber and other incidents, but it's a clear case where our government has actually done a very good job of thwarting these threats for the last 10 years, and that's a great thing. But I think as we look back at September 11th, we have to remember it was a transformative event for much of America, much like Pearl Harbor, much like many other events throughout our history, that it changed the way we live our lives. And if you think back to the world, to what we called 9/10 before 9/11. It was a different world, and we live in a different world. And if you think about how different it was, whether that's good or bad, it is truly remarkable how much our lives have changed.
Yeah, we will have special programming on the Ideas Network on Sunday, September the 11th, the Sunday morning beginning at 7 o'clock in the morning here on the Ideas Network, commemoration and discussion about 9/11, 10 years later, and how life is different today. So let's move on to jobs. President Obama unveiling his jobs plan before Congress last night. Do you like this plan, Ruth Conniff?
Well, I have two reactions to the president's speech last night. The plan is it's somewhat bigger than expected, and in that way, it's a pleasant surprise. It's a more ambitious effort than we expected from the president, who was, you know, has tied his hands with this debt ceiling agreement, and therefore is not going to go back to the kind of ambitious effort that we saw with the stimulus program. And that's too bad, because in fact, a lot of economists agree that that's really what we need in this economy, that the stimulus made a very positive impact, but that it was about half the size it needed to be to truly deal with this huge recession that we're left with. And so I was somewhat, you know, pleasantly surprised by the size of the plan. However, overall, you know, it's a collection of tax breaks, payroll tax breaks, which are an inefficient way, you know, giving businesses money to try to get them to hire new people is not necessarily going to work. It's not necessarily how businesses make their hiring decisions. We need more customers. We need money in people's pockets. We could go directly at job creation. But setting that aside, that was all criticism that I sort of had ready to go before I saw the speech, because there were plenty of parts of it that had leaked out. The speech itself, I thought, was tremendous. Just politically, as a statement, it was very strong. It was very passionate. It was the Obama that we used to see on the campaign trail. And I think it is, you know, the launch of his 2012 campaign. And most of all, it just very clearly stated what's at stake ideologically. I loved listening to him say that we shouldn't be in a race to the bottom, that where we have the cheapest labor and the worst pollution standards. You know, it's, you know, he really clearly defined the idea of a civil society and the defense of a civil society, that we can work together, that we don't just, you know, cut people loose in America and tell everyone to write their own rules, you know, refund their money and tell them they're on their own. That's not the kind of society we want to be. And I think that really speaks to a majority of Americans, to the really anxious and struggling middle class in America. So it's really, with Obama, it's often this divided feeling that I think a lot of progressives get, that the speeches are fantastic, but the devil is in the details.
Yeah. Well, Owen, he urged Congress to, you know, pass this jobs plan right now or right away. Do you want Congress to pass this jobs plan right now, right away?
As outlined by Obama, no. But I would agree with Ruth that it was an impassioned speech, and it was the Obama of old, because this was the first true big speech of the Obama 2012 reelection campaign. And that's really what it was. This was a speech not with, you know, legitimate policy aims to create jobs, because a lot of the stuff, as Ruth indicated, you know, things like the extension of the tax, the payroll tax credit and whatnot, or tax cut, and those things, you know, are things that have done nothing to create jobs over the past 3 years. We're 3 years into the Obama administration, and we're seeing the same rehash of policies that have failed to date to create jobs, and he wants to reintroduce them. So what this really was Obama putting up a bunch of things that he wants to throw up in the face of America and say, if you don't support this, then you don't want to create jobs in America, and he wants to run on that in his 2012 campaign. And that's fine and all, but let's recognize what it is. It is a campaign speech. It was not a true policy speech.
Mm-hmm. Ruth?
Well, was it a true policy speech? I don't disagree there. I think where I probably disagree with Owen is, are these failed policies, and is it nothing? It's not nothing. To me, it's just not enough. And, you know, we weren't going to get enough, because we knew after the deficit ceiling deal that there wasn't going to be money. But I do think that he calls Republicans out on tax cuts in a very interesting way. And he said in the speech, you know, a lot of you have signed a pledge to never, ever increase taxes on anyone so long as you live, which is a reference to the Grover Norquist pledge that a lot of Republican office holders have signed. However, Republicans are now balking at a tax cut for the middle class, which is where it would do the most good, because if people who don't have a lot of money get a little extra money in their pockets, they spend it, and that stimulates the economy. So, you know, that, while I would prefer job creation to tax cuts, I think he is calling them out in an interesting way on that issue, and I think it's going to be very hard for them to resist it. He's opening the door to this quote-unquote entitlement reform, which is really going to be a hot-button issue in this campaign, and I think, you know, the idea of balancing the budget on the backs of the elderly and people on Medicare is really going to be a disaster. But, you know, at the same time, he's saying we need to finally do something about these the ridiculous inequity where Warren Buffett pays a much lower tax rate than his own secretary. You know, let's reinstitute taxes on the very, very wealthy in this country. And so, you know, I think he's sort of calculating that he can make this case in a way that is appealing to just this enormously broad section of the public because these are very reasonable ideas.
Mm-hmm. Owen?
Well, I, for one, am kind of sick and tired of hearing about how Warren Buffett underpays the secretary. You know, that's not my concern.
No, it's her tax break. But... He makes $60,000 a year, which is okay for a secretary, but to pay 30% income tax when he pays 17% on his... on his wealth, on his income from his wealth, is inequitable.
And that's because in America we tax income, not wealth, and that's mm-hmm. a discussion we can certainly have. But I think as we move forward, you know, as again, pulling it back to Obama's speech and his job creation, you mentioned entitlement reform and whatnot. Realistically, we're 14 months away from a general election or presidential election, and nothing whatsoever has happened in true entitlement reform in Obama's entire administration. There's no indication whatsoever that it's going to happen in a divided government before the next election. So it's playing to politics. It means nothing whatsoever in real terms. And so until we get to a point where we are truly serious about talking about entitlement reform, talking about reorganizing the tax structure, talking about whether Warren Buffett should pay more taxes, and frankly, there's nothing preventing him from cutting a check to Congress at any time whatsoever. But, you know, until we get to that point, it's just talk. And that's what Obama has been really good at up till now and continues to be good at. He's great at talking. He has very, very little credibility in doing.
We will take a couple of calls from listeners on the Obama jobs plan unveiled last night, and we will talk about other issues in the news this week with Owen Robinson and Ruth Conniff. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or contact us via Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There should be nothing controversial about this piece of legislation. Everything in here is the kind of proposal that's been supported by both Democrats and Republicans, including many who sit here tonight. And everything in this bill will be paid for. Everything.
That's President Obama last night before a joint session of Congress unveiling the American Jobs Act. And we're talking about the jobs speech right now during this edition of the Week in Review with Ruth Conniff and Owen Robinson. And with you, too. We have some callers who want to weigh in. And Patrick in West Bend is first. Hello, Patrick.
Hi. I like the job speech. I think that it was, there were policy proposals there, and I think there were good policy proposals. There was politics mixed in. But I really like the fact that the president took on some of the, some aspects of the conservative position that I think are just absurd. I mean, I think his point about not having time to wait 14 months before doing something about the economy was spot on. And that seems to be, you know, when you talk to Michelle Bachmann, when you talk to the presidential candidates, that's what they want to do. They just want to wait until they can get total power, and then they'll do something, but they're not specific about what. And, you know, I think it's just basically saying, this economy doesn't matter, let's put it on hold until we can get total power back.
Oh, I'm sorry. We need to get a reaction first from Owen.
Well, I wasn't by any means indicating that we needed to wait 14 months. I was indicating that we were going to wait 14 months because that's what's going to happen, because that's what politics dictate. Even in the Obama speech, he, you know, he demanded, I think it was 16 or 17 times that they pass a bill that he hasn't actually put in front of Congress. So he's demanding they pass a bill that they haven't seen. So it reminds me of the Obamacare debate where, you know, we'll see it once they pass it. But, you know, as far as politicians running for office, of course they're going to want to wait till they're in power. That's how politics work. But certainly our economy demands we do something now. What I was indicating is that the president's speech and his policy ideas, frankly, they're not going to do anything for the economy in the next 14 months, and it was another whiff.
But what the caller is referring to, I think, is that the Republicans have been unwilling to extend unemployment insurance, And they have even threatened to crash our entire economy by defaulting on our debt. I mean, they've moved to sort of an unprecedented level of destructiveness in terms of regular people's lives. And that's why those lines really resonate with people who are saying, come on, you know, these are some basic things that we can get done right now and, you know, protect ourselves from economic disaster.
Well, let's talk about some policy specifics. So if we talk about extending unemployment benefits, right now I believe it's at 99 weeks, I think is where it is now, and Obama wants to extend that further. What does that actually do to spur job creation? If we talk about extending the payroll tax cut, what does that actually, you know, that only applies to people who actually have jobs right now. What does that actually do to spur job creation?
Well,
given that those are things that we have done to date, and we have an unemployment rate at 9.1%, even though Obama promised during his stimulus plan that it wouldn't go over 8%, you know, those are things that haven't worked to date. Why do we think they're going to work again?
Ruth? Well, extending unemployment insurance keeps people from losing their homes and, you know, ending up on food stamps. And, you know, that is a way of just protecting people, protecting families from falling right through the floor. And when we have 9.1% unemployment and a great deal of hard long-term unemployment, it's just basic decency to extend unemployment insurance. I mean, and the, you know, the counter-argument that it's somehow a carrot to remain unemployed is just draconian. I mean, it's really, you know, people should not face total economic disaster, and that's just a basic value.
Let's be clear then. Those aren't job creation initiatives. Those are welfare initiatives, and that's fine if we want to have debate on that point, but let's not pretend they are job creation initiatives.
Well, I don't think anybody's pretending that either the debt crisis
they were
or
part of Obama's speech
is a job creation issue, except to the extent that, you know, we could be doing more. There are other parts of the president's plan that are underfunded because of the way in which this debt ceiling deal has tied his hands. But, you know, doing some more stimulus work, the suggestion that he made that we repair our crumbling schools, rebuild bridges, you know, work on our infrastructure. I mean, these are good ideas that put people to work and take care of things that we need to take care of in this country. We can't finance that adequately if we are, you know, saying that we're going to have a zero-sum budget now.
Let me bring in Ned from Wausau. Hello, Ned.
Hello. I listened to the entire speech and the analysis afterwards, and I thought it was a very energetic speech, very well delivered, and very good on content. In the analysis by some of the people on public television last night, I believe it was, or maybe another network, because I switched around, they said that the ratio of tax cuts to spending would be approximately 60% tax cuts, 40% of spending to stimulate the economy for infrastructure and schools and bridges and so on and roads. And I think that's about approximately the right ratio. Now, if Republicans are going to vote against the tax cuts part, which is more than half of the spending here, $447 billion from what I understand is the estimate, well, then it's just not consistent from what they've stated all along. Now, if they're not going to approve the entire bill as is, which appears to be the case, certainly we could find common ground on some things, and the whole bill to me seems not very controversial because many of the issues in the bill are simply things that people have supported on both sides of the aisle for quite a long time.
All right. Thank you, Ned. A reaction to that, Owen?
Well, you know, when we talk about tax cuts, you know, again, we're talking about essentially the extension of the payroll tax cut, which is what we're talking about. And that's something that I think that we should decrease payroll taxes, but it should be coupled with a decrease in spending that those taxes go to pay for. If we're cutting taxes and just piling it on debt to pay for the spending in the absence of those taxes, then it all it does is harm our kids and our grandkids. So it's a failed policy. So as we look down the road, there are things. But again, I kind of turn it back to what we were talking about a moment ago, and that is that does that create jobs? Is the fact that I get an extra, you know, however many dollars on my paycheck every month because of a payroll tax cut, even though I know that the national debt's running up that I'm going to pay for eventually, does that create jobs? Does that revitalize the American economy. If history is any guide, given that we've had this tax cut in place for quite some time now, the answer is no.
Well, first of all, if it stimulates the economy by putting money in people's pockets and they spend that money, that creates customers for businesses, and that adds jobs in a way that actually offering those businesses a tax break to hire somebody at the end of the year does not. So it does create jobs. Simply for people to have money to spend creates jobs. I mean, that's how the economy works. The payroll tax cut is just an inefficient way to do it for a couple of reasons. One is, to give a payroll tax cut to employers to hire, as I said, is not as effective as just having a better economy and growth so that they are going to hire because they, you know, have confidence their business is going to grow, not because they're going to get a one-time reward. But the other thing is, for individuals, the payroll tax cut is actually a little bit regressive because the top 5% of taxpayers who earn more than $550,000 get about $1,300 in the tax cut money, and the lower 60% who make $2,750 take home $150. So if you want to stimulate the economy, it's actually more effective to give money to people who will spend it. But the more money you give to employers who have a little bit of a pad anyway and might decide not to hire, or to people who already have enough money that they're saving, the less you stimulate the economy.
Let me have you both, Ruth and Owen, take a listen to this excerpt from President Obama's address, and then I want your reaction to it.
I reject the argument that says for the economy to grow, we have to roll back protections that ban hidden fees by credit card companies, or rules that keep our kids from being exposed to mercury, or laws that prevent the health insurance industry from shortchanging patients. I reject the idea that we have to strip away collective bargaining rights to compete in a global economy.
A little shout out there to collective bargaining rights, Ruth Conniff.
Yeah, it's great to hear the president talk that way. It would have been nice to hear him say a little more and say a little more right here in Wisconsin when this was really a live battle here. I have written about that. You know, there were a lot of people who were saying, you know, I guess he still can't find his marching shoes, because during the campaign in 2007, he gave a really rousing speech saying that he would get on the line and march with workers if collective bargaining rights were threatened. But, you know, that laundry list that he gave there, I mean, first of all, it's a great, simple list of values. And secondly, these are things that he really has done something on for the most part, with the exception of the collective bargaining issue. These regulations, the tricks and traps that the credit card industry uses to make money off people, setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, doing something about the pharmaceutical industry, although that's a little bit more tenuous, but just basic regulation protecting clean air, clean water, safety of food and drugs. These are our basic values, and it's hard to argue against them, although, you know, more and more right-wing Republicans do. But again, with Obama, you know, just yesterday we had the news that he's actually weakening the EPA ozone regulation. So smog is not going to be reduced to the degree that it would have been had that regulation stayed in effect. So it's, you know, he says it and you think, yeah, and then you look at what's actually happening on a policy level and you think, oh.
Yeah, well, he said that he was going to deregulate and get rid of some regulations that did not, hurt the health and safety of the American people. Owen, so he wants to do some deregulation, but not everything. And he apparently wanted to shout out collective bargaining. What did you make of that portion?
Well, I find myself in somewhat agreement with Ruth, frankly, as far as Obama's words don't match his actions, in that, you know, frankly, I was pleased that he pulled back the environmental regulations that he was trying to impose that were going to cost American businesses over $1 trillion and pull that out of the economy. I'm glad he pulled that back. But, you know, you look at the specifics, and it's kind of you have to remember this was a political speech, and when he talks about it in those things, when he talks about exposing kids to mercury, for instance, you know, nobody wants our kids to be exposed to mercury, but he puts that in light as if that's the core value of regulations, is to prevent, that sort of death-inducing type of exposure. Those are things that nobody wants, and certainly is an appropriate realm for government to regulate. As opposed to putting, you know, whether we want our cars to have another 4 miles per gallon and whatnot. You know, it's a very disparate view of how regulations work in the economy. But also you look at the hypocrisy, if you will. I don't like to use that term because it's loaded, but it really is a hypocrisy, where he's also continuing to push, for instance, the high-efficiency light bulbs, which have mercury in them that kids can be exposed to, as opposed to the incandescent light bulbs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like that, where those are out there. But it, specific to collective bargaining, again, I agree with Ruth. You know, he goes out there and talks a good game. He did nothing here. But frankly, I'm happy with the way things have gone in Wisconsin in regard to collective bargaining. But the president doesn't have a lot of you know, oomph, if you will, when talking about those issues, because when the issues were in front of us and we're dealing with them, he was nowhere to be found.
We need to move on to some other issues and another big event this week on the other side of the partisan divide, the Republican presidential candidates debate on Wednesday night. And here's a clip that involves the front runners, Mitt Romney and Rick Perry. Let's take a listen.
I came into a state that was in real trouble. Huge budget gap, losing jobs every month. We turned it around. 3 out of 4 years, we had unemployment rate below the national average. We ended up with 4.7% unemployment rate. I'm proud of what we were able to do in a tough situation.
Time, Governor Perry.
I know back and forth, but Michael Dukakis created jobs 3 times faster than you did, Mitt.
Well, as a matter of fact, George Bush and his predecessor created jobs at a faster rate than you did, Governor.
That's not correct.
Yeah, that is correct.
So who has the best jobs record? Owen Robinson, your thoughts on that exchange and the debate in general?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think both Romney, speaking specifically about the economy and job creation, both Romney and Perry both have strong records. They both did a good job in their relative states, taking advantage of the situation that was in each of their states to create jobs. And they have a good argument. Frankly, I think Perry is weak on a number of other items. But, you know, here you have, if you're talking about a presidential run, you have two candidates who have actually, in their states, they have proven track records over multiple years of creating jobs, of revitalizing the economy, whether the overall economy was up or down. You know, look at Texas right now, where the economy has been in recession now for, you know, several years. I know officially it's come out, but we're all, I don't think we think we're booming. Anybody thinks we're booming at this time. But if, you know, where Texas is far exceeded the national average in both job creation and revenue and all those things, you know, they have good records in these items, and those are going to be hard things for Obama to counter because, frankly, again, we're coming up on 3 years with him in office, and our economy is still faltering.
You know, I said front runners, Mitt Romney and Rick Perry, and Rick Perry is leading in many public opinion polls. Some are saying after this debate, Owen, that it is now a two-candidate race. It is Romney or Perry. Do you think that's accurate or too soon to say?
I think that's fairly accurate. I think if you look at the other ones that people want to, frankly, I think Bachman is unelectable in a national race. I think that, you know, Ron Paul, he's run for years and years and years and has never gained a national traction. I think he's not electable in a national race. I think it is a two-man race at this point.
And your thoughts on the debate, Ruth Conniff?
Well, I think the debate just shows the total upside-down world of these Republican candidates, because here you have Mitt Romney, whose state ranks first for covering people who are uninsured, offering them health insurance, running away from and on the defensive on that record. And you've got Rick Perry, whose state ranks dead last on this, by the same measure, and he is the hero because, you know, in the worldview of the Republican base, it's great to have tons of uninsured people, and it's really suspect to have provided nearly universal health insurance in your state. But I think, you know, what Romney was referring to when he took that jab at Perry, and I think he really kind of won that round, was that if Bush created more jobs than Perry, you know, Bush, people really do remember, was responsible for this economic recession that we're in. I mean, these policies that the Republicans tout, these tax breaks for corporations, deregulation, they create an environment like we see in Texas, which is on fire currently, where you've got huge rates of, they're dead last for a number of high school graduates, huge rates of poverty, You know, they've created jobs at minimum wage and below, and people don't have insurance. And Perry defends that. I mean, he says, you know, the federal government, you know, people want the federal government out of their lives more than they want health care. And I think, you know, that was the reference. You know, when they said Bush to Perry, that's a reference that resonates with a lot of people. That's not where the American people want to go. And polls show that people really feel that it was the 8 years of the Bush regime that are responsible for the economic downturn that we're in now. So I just thought it was odd to see, you know, Romney's on the run for having basically a state that most of us would rather live in. And you really have to ask yourself, you know, what kind of a country do we want to live in, and what's it going to look like if it's in this completely deregulated environment?
Let me ask you, too, Owen, whether you think that Rick Perry's defense of his statement that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme is going to help him or hurt him.
No, I think it will help him in the long run, but to respond to Ruth's comment, you know, frankly, a state we want to live in, it's an interesting line of attack from you, Ruth, in that, you know, Massachusetts is a largely homogenous, white, middle-class, upper-class state, whereas Texas has a large Hispanic population,
on,
a large African-American population. Has you know, it's a much more diverse state.
No, you know, you're not going to come out calling me a racist for not being a racist.
Hold on. I mean, she didn't. I'm sure Ruth was not.
That's just completely ridiculous. And I think you know
really?
That. And I think that's a pretty low road to try to take.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, again, Romney took over a state that is largely white, upper-class, middle-class, homogenous kind of state, whereas Perry is dealing with a state which a much larger population, much more diverse, both in population, both in ethnic background, both in economic background, all those things, and dealt with them differently. So it's interesting that you want us all to live in Massachusetts, but
no,
that's just not the world we live in.
What I'm
but
saying, and
specifically
I think it's pretty...
Wait a minute, Ruth. Let's move into the... you can talk about the debate, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about the Social Security being a Ponzi scheme as one of the highlights of that debate, Owen.
I think that Perry's accusation of that is accurate to an extent. It's accurate in that people on the lower rungs of the Social Security scheme, which I consider myself in, frankly, we're paying for those who have paid into it for years who are now receiving the benefits. It is a plan where there's no lockbox, if you will, out there where all those funds are secured, where they're going to pay for people in the future. It relies on people at the lower rungs coming in to pay for it. And why it's failing is because there aren't enough people coming in at the lower rungs to pay for the people who are now receiving benefits. That's what the extent of the issue is. The difference between a true Ponzi scheme and Social Security is that, one, there's no fraud involved. Everybody knows. Everybody who's looking at it, myself included, knows that I'm paying into a system right now that I will likely not receive any benefit from in the future. But that brings in the other difference is that I'm legally and, you know, mandated to pay into it. If I don't, I go to jail. So we're using the coercive power of government to enforce a Ponzi scheme right now that everybody knows is a Ponzi scheme, but it is what it is. So I think Perry's characterization is pretty accurate.
Well, good luck winning a presidential election by telling people that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. I mean, that's just ridiculous. It's a Ponzi scheme is defrauding people. Social Security is a system of social insurance that, you know, people rely on to have a decent retirement, and it's a pillar of just basic protection for the elderly. We don't have this indigent elderly population in this country because FDR was able to pass Social Security. And I think Obama really spoke to majority of Americans when he said, think what our country would be like if that hadn't happened. You know, the system is also solvent, and the $2.6 trillion in reserves don't add to our national debt. They are not even considered part of the national debt in terms of a, you know, legally, but it is in surplus. So there is enough money there, and the question of how to continue to have a Social Security system that's solvent is a question that, you know, it is basically a question of our priorities and our values. And, you know, we could afford to, just by repealing the Bush tax cuts, to keep Social Security solvent for even more decades into the future.
Let me get one more call in on the debate, and then we need to move on to some other issues again. Marie in Milwaukee. Hi, Marie.
Hello. I have 2 points now.
Can you give us your most important point?
My most important point is that as I watched the debate on Tuesday night, I was just struck by the fact that we might have a president that doesn't believe in science, that science is not a part of the beliefs of someone, that he doesn't, that these, some of these people don't even believe that in the fact that people are, you know, part of what's happening to our planet.
Right. And I thank you very much, Marie. And this came up in the debate. And in Utah, Governor John Huntsman, in fact, spoke out saying we can't be anti-science when it comes to things like global warming and evolution. Owen, what do you say to that?
Well, if you want a president who doesn't believe in God, which is, I think, what we're actually talking about here, you know, you're going to have to go back quite a ways to one who doesn't, frankly. And, you know, I think that this issue in particular speaks to where government is in our lives today, where if whether or not the government believes in evolution or creationism, whether or not they believe in, you know, global warming or not, or whether they think it's something that's created by the sun, which is, you know, a giant ball of gas creating heat on our planet. You know, whether or not, you know, all those things that come into play, if government isn't involved in our lives on those matters, who gives a rip whether or not the president cares about those things or not, because he has no influence on our lives. So I think it's a message that, you know, as we get nitpicky about these things on our presidential candidates, whether they believe in this, the other thing, frankly, if the federal government wasn't involved in our lives to that extent, we wouldn't care, and we shouldn't care.
Mm-hmm. Ruth?
I think we need to care, and I think when Rick Perry said that Galileo got outvoted for a spell by way of explaining his lack of belief in climate change, that's very significant. It's significant to Texans who are right now dealing with the effects of climate change. As most climate scientists agree, these wildfires would not be burning to the extent that they are if we hadn't had this increase in temperature and the evaporation from the soil, leaving it dry and leaving a lot of tinder out there. So, you know, that was such a strange comment that he made. And I think, once again, it just shows the parallel universe that these Republican candidates live in. And, I mean, what's particularly strange about it, of course, is that Galileo was promoting what is now totally accepted science and was punished for it by a church that said, no, you know, we refuse to accept this. And you know, Perry's actually on the opposite side, which is, I think, why he's backpedaling and his spokesman is unwilling to even talk about that remark.
We need to take a short break. We will come back with the Week in Review quiz. We're going to talk about some controversial remarks made at Labor Day rallies on Monday. And we'll talk about this this flap over voter ID and free voter IDs after this break. 1-800-642-1234. This is the Week in Review. Owen Robinson is with us. He is a columnist at the West Bend Daily News and blogger at bootsandsabers.com. And Ruth Conniff is our other guest, political editor at The Progressive Magazine. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's time for the Week in Review quiz. This week, the White House announced that this year's Christmas tree will come from Wisconsin. In what city is the Christmas tree farm that won this year's National Christmas Tree Association contest? If you think you know, would like to guess, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We will select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will be offered a fabulous prize, a book that was featured on the program. So the question is, what city will the White House Christmas tree come from? It's in Wisconsin. Which Wisconsin city? All right. Time now to talk about more issues in the news this week with Ruth Conniff and Owen Robinson. Lots of issues and not a lot of time. Let me start with U.S. Representative Connie Tammy Baldwin is running for U.S. Senate. She announced this week that she wants to replace Herb Kohl, who is not running for re-election. Ruth Conniff, Tammy Baldwin, a strong candidate for U.S. Senate?
Yeah, I think she is. I think a lot of people have watched her career and what a great campaigner she is and how organized she is and how she basically won Russ Feingold's seat back for him just through her tremendous organizing on the UW campus here. The question now is whether she can take herself out of her really liberal district in Madison and move her campaign statewide. And I think, you know, that's the question that everybody is asking. And, you know, I think that she wouldn't do it if she didn't think that she could do it, and that she has spent a lot of time traveling around the state and doing her own research to figure that out. And I think she's going to be a very strong candidate.
Mm-hmm. Owen Robinson, your thoughts?
Well, I agree. To a lot of that. I think she's a formidable candidate. I think she does have to transform herself into a statewide candidate versus a Dane County candidate, in essence. I think she'll run a good campaign. She's going to be well-funded. I think the Republicans need to look out to, not underestimate her. She is a good campaigner. She's going to be well-funded, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. So who do you think is going to for sure be on the ballot for the primary for on the Republican side, Owen?
Well, I think for sure, that's a big question. You're talking for the general election. I think Tommy certainly has the statewide name recognition and is going into that. There's Newman, there's Cannabis, there's Fitzgerald, there's Lassay. There's a lot of candidates going in, and I think that just shows how attractive that race is on the conservative side of the ticket right now.
Yeah, you blogged about the National Club for Growth criticizing Tommy Thompson as being a big spender or something like that. You don't think that's fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair to characterize Tommy as a big spender. I think he was. That letter was specifically regarding Newman in that his campaign for governor last year against Scott Walker was unethical in my mind. He lied both to me, to my face, frankly. In an instance, he lied behind the scenes to people and then tried to say things different in public. I don't think he is a man of character. And I'm not appreciative of national groups stepping into to Wisconsin because, frankly, Wisconsin conservatives had a good record of putting forth good conservatives, both with Scott Walker, with Paul Ryan, with Reince Priebus, with Reed Ribble, with, a lot of people were, putting into the national scene who are now considered national players. I'm not appreciative of national groups stepping in uninformed about Newman's character and trying to thrust him upon us as a candidate.
Yeah. Do you, Ruth Conniff, think that Tammy Baldwin will face any primary competition, maybe from Congressman Ron Kind or former Congressman Steve Kagan?
I don't know for sure, but I think that there's been a lot of kind of waiting and making sure that on the Democratic side that people have their ducks in a row. And so I think one reason that we got this announcement when we did is because Russ Feingold definitively took himself out of the race. So I think that you're not going to see the kind of disarray on the Democratic side that you may see on the Republican side. And I think that the party's going to unite behind Tammy. And I also think that people are really hungry for a progressive message in this state right now, and there's going to be a tremendous amount of energy and excitement for an actually progressive Democrat to be running. And I think, that whole flap that Owen is talking about is, it's an interesting example of how the right has really made inroads in taking over our state. And to the extent that when we saw those Club for Growth ads, we thought, really, Tommy Thompson is the enemy now? I mean, I think the Republicans appear so out of touch and so far to the right that it is really a ripe environment for Democrats.
Let me ask you, Ruth Conniff, first, whether you think there is anything wrong with Teamsters President Jimmy Hoffa and Vice President Joe Biden, for that matter, making controversial comments on Labor Day during the Labor Day rallies. Hoffa said Tea Party people, Republicans, were SOBs, and he says that Labor was going to help take them out at the ballot box. He was talking about voting. And Biden called called the Tea Partiers barbarians. was there anything wrong with that?
Well, I think if Owen can call me a racist on national public radio, that those are pretty mild comments, actually. You know, I think that it's not helpful to say things that sound, you know, for Jimmy Hoffa to talk about taking people out does not resonate particularly well. But, you know, I think that the Tea Partiers have been so provocative, and that message has been so aggressive, and particularly here in Wisconsin, where people are really feeling the impact of those kinds of politics, you know, I think it's not really surprising.
Mm-hmm. Owen?
Jimmy Hoffa is his father's son.
And that's all you want to say?
Yep.
All right. Well, we have time then for we have time then to talk about this flap-over photo ID. The latest in this story is that a state employee, a lower level state employee, was fired yesterday after he sent an email to other DOT employees telling them about the Department of Transportation's policy of not giving out free photo IDs unless someone asked for it specifically. First of all, Ruth Conniff, what do you think of this whole thing on you don't get a free photo ID unless you specifically ask for one?
I think it's another example of voter suppression, and we've seen a lot of examples of this from the Walker administration. And, you know, first of all, the photo ID requirement just out of the gate is a way of suppressing particularly African-American votes, and I think the Republicans know that, and that's the reason that they favor the photo ID requirement. People who don't have driver's licenses, who are low-income voters, the elderly, there are a lot of people who are they're not going to be able to vote. It's a way of disenfranchising people, and this is just an extra layer. Now people who can't afford the photo ID are not to be told that they should be getting it free. So it just suppresses the vote, and Republicans calculate largely Democratic votes.
Does this story trouble you at all, Owen?
Well, bear in mind you have two stories here. First, you have an employee who was an assistant associate of shipping or something, sending emails about policy to the entire group. That is inappropriate. And the fact that he was fired, you know, without knowing the entire case, that, you know, that's something that that should be looked at. As far as whether or not IDs are advertised as free or not, you know, frankly, it's an entitlement. You can get a free ID if you want to vote. It's there. I don't know that that clerks should be at every time somebody comes up to get an ID saying, hey, by the way, you can get this for free. That's an appropriate policy, particularly in our budget times.
Let me announce that the winner of the quiz is John in Kimberly. John correctly answered that the White House Christmas tree is coming from Nina this year, Schrader's Forever Greens. And we congratulate him. Ruth, Owen, you think the White House is picking Wisconsin for the Christmas tree because we're a swing state?
Could be.
You never know. All right. Owen Robinson and Ruth Conniff, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy, and thank you, Ruth.
Ruth Conniff, political editor at the Progressive Magazine. Owen Robinson, columnist at the West Bend Daily News. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Michelle Good for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.